midday. I'm not sure if I should say good morning or good afternoon, but welcome. My name's Nicole Aberdy. Welcome to today's session. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that this land that we meet on today is the traditional land for the Kaurna people and that I respect their spiritual relationship with their country. I also acknowledge the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region and that their cultural and heritage beliefs are still as important to the living Kaurna people today. Today, I'm fortunate to be in conversation with Kate Brenville, one of Australia's most celebrated and beloved writers, about her latest book, Restless Dolly Maunder. In it, Kate breathes life into the untold story of her maternal grandmother, born into a farming family in country New South Wales in the late 19th century, the sixth of seven children, with limited education and limited choices. Kate Brenville, AO. Over the course of her 40-year writing career, Kate has published 17 books. These include 10 novels, which include The Idea of Perfection, which won the Orange Prize for Women's Fiction, just now called the Women's Prize for Fiction, the much-loved Australian classic Secret River, which won the Commonwealth Writers' Prize and was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize and was, of course, adapted for the stage and made into a TV series. She's also published the story of her mother's life, One Life, in 2015. We'll be talking a little bit about that today. Some books about the writing process and a non-fiction book called The Case Against Fragrance. Kate's books have been published around the world and translated into many languages. She has a Doctorate of Creative Arts from UT at the University of Technology, Sydney, and honorary doctorates from Sydney University, Macquarie, and the University of New South Wales. In 2017, Kate was awarded the Australian Council Award for Lifetime Achievement in Literature in recognition of her extraordinary contribution to Australian literature. Kate received the Order of Australia in 2018. In 2020, A Room Made of Leaves won the Christina Stead Prize for Fiction and was shortlisted for several other major awards. Today, we will be discussing Restless Dolly Maunder, published by Text in July 2023. There have been a number of good reviews, but I think The Guardian review says it best. This book is a work of history, biography, story, and memoir, all fused into a novel that suggests the great potential of literary art as redeemer, healer, and pathway to understanding. The most fantastic news that I'm now able to share with you, because it's been announced overnight, is that Kate's book, Restless Dolly Maunder, that we're talking about today, has just overnight been longlisted in the UK for the Women's Prize for Fiction. Which, just to remind you, she won in 2001. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you so much, Nicole. Yes, having won it once, I don't actually expect to get any further with the Women's Prize, but how fabulous to be on that list.
The only Australian, I think I'm right in saying, yeah. Kate. I think you're the only Australian. Yes. Anna Funder's on the list for the inaugural non-fiction prize.
Yeah, I think you may be right.
I think you're the only Australian on this list. So, Kate, your first impressions of your maternal grandmother, Dolly, were based on the stories that your mother, Nance, Dolly's only daughter, told you. How did Nance, your mother, describe her mother, Dolly, and the relationship between them?
Well, Mum had a very, let's say, mixed relationship with her mother. Her mother was, as well as being restless, a very powerful personality, and my mother did use the word bully more than once in relation to her own mother. So when Grandma came to live with us when I was about five or six, I was probably kind of I was probably prepped to meet a certain kind of woman. But I certainly met her. The grandma that I remember from her coming to live in the flat next door was of a very cranky, a thin, wrinkled, cranky, unsmiling, scolding sort of person. And I only have a few memories of her, but I will share my most vivid one, because in many ways it's where this book started. I've remembered it all these years. It's getting on for 70 years, not quite, but nearly. Anyway, I'm 5 or 6 years old. I'm playing in the garden, digging dirt, which was my favourite game. I think I should have been an archaeologist. And Grandma came out of her flat and stood over me, and I remember looking up at this, what seemed like a very tall, lean, you know, stern person peering down at me. So I'm looking up and she says, do you love me, Kathy? Well, my mother had done a good job. She'd brought me up to be very truthful. She might have regretted that she hadn't also added sometimes a white lie is better than the truth. So I looked up at this frightening face and said, no. And the look on her face, I can't put an adjective to it, but it has stayed with me for 70 years. I think there was probably a bit of shock, probably a bit of hurt, looking back. Obviously, there would have been. But also maybe something else, maybe a sort of recognition. Yeah, I'm probably not lovable. So, I'm sorry, I'm probably not really answering your question.
You are.
But I'm going to go off on this riff. when I myself became a grandma 4 years ago, the image of my own grandmother came back to me very vividly, particularly that moment. Why would an old woman lean down to her little child, a granddaughter she barely knew, and say, do you love me? So I began to think, would I do that with my grandchildren? Not in a million years. I know they love me the way children and I love them. You know, it's just not on the agenda. So that's what made me think, that's who she was, but the interesting question is, why was she like that? And that's really, I start every book with a question, and that was the book that I started, that was the question that I started this book with. Why was Grandma the way that both Mum and I experienced her?
Kate, I'm wondering as we speak, I hadn't thought about this before, but we're going to come to talk in a little bit more detail about the problematic relationship between Dolly and Nance, your mother. But I'm wondering now if maybe Dolly had never asked her own daughter that, and maybe she regretted that she hadn't, so she thought she'd ask her granddaughter.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it. I had not thought of that. I think also perhaps, yeah, maybe it was a kind of practice run. She'd ask this little child, who no one would take any notice of, and then depending on how it worked, she might ask her daughter, for whom it did matter. What a very insightful thing to notice.
When you started researching Nance's life, that's your mother's life, for the book that you wrote about her, One Life, the story of her life, you say that you met someone you never expected to meet. Could you tell us a little bit about the Dolly that you discovered?
Yes. Look, once you ask yourself why was Dolly the way she was, you start to think about the world that she was born into. She was born in 1880 on a not particularly prosperous farm just outside of a little tiny place called Currabubbula. Now, Currabubbula is tiny, but I'm always surprised when I talk to people how many people have actually been there. Is anybody in this audience by any... Yes, there you see. People have been to Currabubbula. It's kind of near Tamworth, so it's up in northern New South Wales. So her father was probably illiterate, her mother not much better. She was saved by public education. The year after she was born, public education became compulsory. And therefore my mother had just those few years of education that people then got. I've forgotten what your question was.
Who was the Dolly that you discovered?
Oh, yeah.
So with your own impressions of her and what your mother had told you, who was the Dolly that you discovered when you started working your way through the family archival materials?
What I discovered was a woman who had been born into that world of very limited opportunity. She had had one chance, which was to train as a teacher, but for reasons which we may go into in a minute, she had been deprived of that. So what I discovered was a woman of incredible drive and intelligence, determination, and also an incredible business sense, which I have to say I didn't inherit. She made sure that the family sort of took every opportunity that it could, and that she herself somehow forged a life of some degree of independence and sort of, financial independence for herself. All the things that a woman born in that situation in 1880 would not normally have had. So she was, in fact, a remarkable woman, a pioneer of a kind.
Kate, tell us about the materials that you had. I know that your mother left behind quite detailed memoirs. There was also some photographs. Could you just talk a little bit about the research process, how you extracted from those materials the character that we read about in this book?
Yeah, so I had quite a lot from my mother. My mother left a lot of memoirs, which was why I was able to write her story. But those memoirs necessarily involved her very intrusive kind of mother, who had such a big influence on her. So I had those, and I recognised that they were written from my mother's point of view. You can't expect a daughter to fully understand a mother. My own daughter may not actually fully understand me. So I was going to read that sideways with a big pinch of salt. But I did, from that, learn all the actual events of my grandmother's life. And that was a big help, because it meant that I had I had the story. It was very often, particularly with women, you don't actually know what they did. So that was a huge resource. I'm very, very grateful to my mother.
You said, talking about the sort of writing that you do, which is a blend, I don't want to call it historical fiction, it's not the right description, but what you do where you take some historical facts and then you mix them in with some imagination, I suppose, want a better word. You've said, what I love is to take a kind of skeletal body of facts and burrow into that in a way that then explodes out into much wider questions about human nature. And I'm wondering, what in this book were the wider questions about human nature that you were able to explore?
I think that desire, particularly for women, let's not say human nature, but the nature of women has been in the past to be blocked, or even to block ourselves from fulfilling all the things we want to be. It's pretty difficult to be all those things. So I think I looked at my grandmother's story. She got married. She had to get married. And they went to live on a farm. They farmed the farm for about 7 years and they never got a crop, my mother said. It rained or it didn't rain, or the hail came in the seventh year. And my grandmother apparently stood at the stove, banging it with a saucepan, saying, "Bert, we're leaving. We're not going to stay here anymore," watching the sky for whatever the weather's going to bring. So she said, we're going to get a little grocery shop. So they started with a grocery shop, but they then bought and sold pubs all around country New South Wales for the next 10 years. And it was my grandmother's business acumen and drive and ambition. My grandfather was a good fellow, but he would have been very content to just land in one place and stay there. Mm. He was a fabulous mine host. I can imagine him behind the bar. But my grandmother, as soon as the place was up and running and sort of had got better, she would want to sell it, move on, do the next thing. Mm. I mean, it's capitalism, isn't it? Mm. She was nature's capitalist. So that's something very foreign to me in a way, except that as a writer, I know that drive. Mm-hmm. It's a different ambition, but the feeling is the same. I will not be stopped from doing this, no matter what life does to me.
So let's go back and look just a little bit at Dolly's childhood. She was born, as you say, in rural New South Wales in 1881. Could you tell us a little bit about her childhood, particularly about her father and about her having to leave school at 14?
Yeah, Mum told me a lot about her mother's childhood. It was tough. Thomas Maunder was Dolly's father's name, and he ran mostly sheep. And in those days, it's incredible what a difference technology makes to a life. In those days, fencing wire was a very rare and expensive object. So if you had sheep, you had to have shepherds. And as anybody knows who's been to, say, the Middle East, quite young children are quite good shepherds. You know, you can farm them out. So that's what all the Maunder children had to do growing up. In the absence of fences, they worked for their father as shepherds. But as I said, the three youngest children were just in time to get compulsory education at the local little school, the one horse, one teacher school. And when Dolly left on her 14th birthday, as they all had to, she came home and she said to her father, "I would like to train as a teacher. I want to become a pupil teacher," which is how you did it in those days. And according to the family story my mother told, he slapped his hand on the table and said, "Over my dead body, any daughter of mine goes out to work." And Mum explained to me that it was because it would bring shame on him. Mm. It would make it look as though he couldn't afford to support his family. So it was all about him. But that was the only possible outlet for my grandmother's drive. She really wanted to be a teacher. It's a tragedy that she wasn't.
So once that door was shut to her, what then happened? What was her life like after she left school at 14?
Well, she would have worked in the kitchen with her mother and out in the paddocks for the next 14 years or so until she was 29, and the pressure was really on to get married. Nobody wanted to be a spinster in those days. So at 29, a man called Bert, who'd come to work for her father, had been circling for a long time, courting very assiduously. And finally, kind of in desperation, Dolly said, yes, OK. So they got married, and you mentioned photographs. I only have a few photographs of my grandmother, but one of them is her wedding photo, probably not actually taken on the day, probably taken in a studio during their honeymoon is how I picture it. Bert is standing there, and he's already got a somewhat resigned look on his face. Dolly is standing there, clutching the bouquet as if to strangle it. And I cannot describe the look of utter bitterness on her face. Mm. Her mouth is turned down. Her eyes are squeezed into little small things because she's clearly been crying. Mm. It's the most horrendous, poignant, in fact, heartbreaking wedding photo
I've ever seen. Saddest wedding photo I've ever seen. And that's not in this book. That's in the earlier book. That book is reproduced... That photo is reproduced in your mother's story in One Life, 2015. And, Kate, we were talking a little bit before about how that book, One Life, and this can be read in a way as companion volumes. Would you like to talk a bit about that?
Indeed. Look, I wrote Mum's book because Mum had always wanted her life to be written about. Now, my mother had a life story that was a little bit unusual. She trained as a pharmacist because her mother bullied her into it at a time when very few women had a proper paid job. And there were very few women pharmacists. So that part of her life was unusual, and she actually owned her own businesses as a pharmacist, which, again, was highly unusual for a woman in the 40s and 50s. So I knew that about her, and Mum had always said, I know that my story is the story of hundreds of thousands of other women. That's why I'm writing these memoirs. Because the story of so many people should not be forgotten. Women who had to struggle up from nothing, really, at a time when women had a rotten time of it, basically. So she wrote these memoirs, and I was just smart enough, just before she died, to realise how important it was to tell those stories about women who are otherwise forgotten. Dolly, even more so, working-class women of the 19th century, they have vanished from the record. The gentry, yes, we have their letters and their diaries. Women like Dolly, they're like an extinct species. So Mum knew that. It wasn't that she thought she was anything very special. On the contrary, she knew that she represented a whole generation. She was born in 1912, just to give you the thing. So when she died, it took me a while to be able to bear to read her things again. But when I did, I thought, I have to tell her story. She would be pleased that I did. And I'm filling in, as I think I've done my whole writing career, wanting to fill in, anyway, gaps in the story of the past, that stories that ought to be told and haven't been.
Let's just tell people a little bit about Bert. So Dolly had known Bert from a very early age. So just perhaps if you could give us a little bit about Bert, who she ends up marrying at the age of 29, after she's had some other romances that go wrong for various reasons. Could you just give us a bit of background about Bert, what he was like, what his background was?
Okay, Bert's story is interesting. Bert's mother was a woman called Mary Russell. Now, on the record, she's described as a widow, but she had eight children. This is after she was a widow. She had eight children altogether. So what I'm picturing is a woman who either was in fact a widow and was left with two little girls. She did have two little girls at the beginning. So either her husband died or, as many men did in those days, she was deserted. One way or another, she was left in this little country town with two little children. Now, how does a woman actually survive to put bread on the table? Now, I don't know, but in terms of a story that I would love to be able to fill in a bit more about, Mary Russell's is overwhelmingly one. Talk about stories not told, and yet her story, again, would be repeated hundreds of thousands of times. Women who had no recourse except what Mary probably did. So what that means is that Bert was the third or fourth of those children, and across his birth certificate, I've actually sent away for it, is scrawled from one corner to the other, illegitimate. Mm. There could be no mistake that my grandfather was illegitimate, father not named. Now, I think people respond differently to that growing up in that kind of world, but my feeling is that it made Bert respect what a hard time women had, particularly single women at that time. So you couldn't say that Bert was in any way a feminist, but he was not going to stand in Dolly's way. He respected her intelligence, and although I'm sure he went against her sometimes, in the end, he always did what she thought they should do. Mm. Now, that's very unusual. In a funny way, she picked really well. He wasn't the man she chose, but actually, they worked it out well because, as I say, I think Bert was a man of kind of deep understanding about what women had to put up with.
He was hardworking too, which was so important. It was like, in a sense, she was the brains behind the whole operation or the set, but he was prepared to work hard, and he had... You write about him saying he was a man that had a lot of natural charm, so when he worked in the grocery shop, or more particularly, came to work in the pubs, people liked him. He had a gift with people.
He did have a gift with people, and it got him into all sorts of trouble. Charming men usually do leave a trail of various kinds of disaster behind them, and my grandfather most certainly did. But he was a hard worker. He was a shearer in his early days, and he still had... I remember when I was a child, he showed me, when he came to live with us, separately from my grandmother, he unwrapped an ancient, oiled, rather dirty singlet of the kind that shearers wear, a blue singlet, and in there was this enormous pair of what they called the blades, the old-fashioned shearers. I see a few of you nodding in the audience. They're like enormous garden shears. I mean, even to just close them, it takes an enormous amount of muscular power. So he had that kind of physical strength. He didn't mind hard work. And look, I'm a bit of a fan of Bert, actually. I wish I'd got to know him better.
Kate, as you said, over a 10-year period, they moved from farming to owning the grocery store in Wurrunga in Sydney, and then they move around and they own, I think, six or seven other different pubs. All of this is driven by Dolly. Just as they're starting to do well at one, she thinks, all right, well, let's, you know, we want to keep moving, we want to keep improving ourselves. She suggests that they move on to another. And in this way, they become financially successful. I'm wondering, was her business acumen and her entrepreneurial spirit unusual for a woman in those days?
Oh, look, why would it have been? I mean, look around this audience. If we did a poll of this audience, probably most of you women, would have had some kind of ambition. You may not be running businesses, but there'd be something that you would be wanting to do. Well, why not back in those days as well? Every time I watch women playing in an orchestra or women CEOs, you know, on television, let alone women members of parliament, I think, what did they do 100 years ago? They still had that intelligence and that drive and that wanting to do something, but it was closed off at every step. What did they do? I mean, a lot of them went a bit mad, I think.
There's one thing that's different, though, and you make the point a few times in the book, that all of the main documents relating to property, leases, licences, title deeds, they all had to be in the man's name, didn't they?
Look, even when I was 24, I wanted to buy a house, and I had a boyfriend at the time, but we weren't going to be married or anything. But I went to the bank to ask for a loan, and he said, oh, well, no, we don't give loans to single women. So I said to Ian, could we pretend to be engaged? And Ian went along with it, nice guy. So I went back to the bank manager with Ian, and I said, well, we're engaged to be married. And so he doled out the money, probably to us, I would think, not just to me. But for the next 20 years, every time I saw that bank manager, he'd rush out of his office rubbing his hands. When's the happy day? When's the happy day?
But whose name was on the title deeds, Kate? Was it both your names?
It was both our names. I had to buy him out when we finally parted the ways. And by then it was okay. I could do it by then.
I want to talk now about Dolly's relationship with her children, in particular her two older children, her son Frank, who was her older son, and most particularly Nance, your mother. Let's start with the early days. Right from the word go, Dolly's relationship with both of those children is difficult, but particularly as Nance gets older, the relationship between mother and daughter is really very fraught. Could you talk a little bit about that and why you think that might have been?
Yeah, I think there were a couple of reasons. First of all, I think the relationship between a mother and a daughter is very different, I think, from my own experience and from what I've seen, than mother and son. Mothers, a daughter always has to separate herself from her mother, and that's quite a difficult, in sort of psychoanalytic terms, that's quite a big journey to take. It has to be done. For a boy, it's much easier. There's clearly, you know, you're already different and you grow into your manhood. So a girl has to forge her own way of being a woman that is not the same as her mother's way of being a woman. So I think that would be kind of one underlying thing. But I think also, more pungently with Dolly, I think that she could see that her daughter was going to go into not quite as bad a world as she had, but a world where a woman's ambition was not respected, a woman's opinion was not respected. So when my mother was at high school, at Tamworth High School, she was pretty, but most of all she had a kind of animation and, I suspect, a wit about her that the boys liked. She had plenty of boyfriends. And I think that Dolly was worried that her daughter would simply drift into a world where she would just get married, have children and do all that stuff, whereas Dolly, having longed to do something, you know, something else herself, wanted that for her daughter, who was clearly intelligent. And that's why she bullied Mum into doing pharmacy, because pharmacy was, in those days, one of the few businesses that a woman could run herself, even with a family. And above all, it was not being an employee. The marriage bar didn't apply. If a woman was a pharmacist, she was paid the same amount as a man pharmacist beside her. Very unusual.
And so, she didn't have to stop work when she married either,
did
she?
That's right, exactly. So I think those things made it difficult because, you know, what daughter wants to be bullied into a career that's, yes, going to be terrific and give her financial independence, but probably not what she wants. My mother actually wanted to do literature and languages, and here she was being bullied into, you know, pharmacy is highly scientific. I have looked at it a bit and, I mean, I couldn't do it.
And she was one of the first, or she was one of the only women studying chemistry. So I think you write in the book that you don't actually study, or your mother didn't actually study pharmacy. She does biology and chemistry and then an apprenticeship as a pharmacist. But in those subjects that she is doing at university, she's one of the very few women, Nance, isn't she?
That's right. I found a photograph of her at Sydney University, and there's the great banks of men in suits. And down in the front of the middle, I think there are four rather kind of chewed up looking women. They're obviously having a hard time. But they were there. Good on them.
And one of the, you've just touched on it, but Nance loved literature. And in fact, ironically, she wanted to do teaching. Mm. And what did Dolly say to her when Nance said, I don't want to do pharmacy, Mum, I want to do teaching?
Yeah, unbelievably, Dolly said, over my dead body. Now, what's that about? Isn't life mysterious? I mean, if I had not read that in the family memoirs, who would dare make that up?
Yeah. So let's just look at Dolly's situation. It seems, and you make it very clear, that at every stage her choices are so limited. So at age 14, she's the smartest girl in the class, but her father won't let her do teaching. She's in her late 20s. If she doesn't marry, well, what would happen? If she didn't marry and she lived her life as an unmarried woman, what would that have been like?
She would have had to look after her parents until they died and then be, you know, the pitiable spinster. It really was a rotten time to be a spinster. But I'm sure you're going to get to the cheerful bit, but I don't want you feeling that Dolly's life was one great moan and that this is a misery memoir, because actually she grabbed life with both hands and made a go of it.
Absolutely. Yep. I think the path I just wanted to take us down was that she had just so very few choices. What if she'd, once she was married and she'd had her child, what if she'd left her husband? What if the marriage, hypothetically, no spoilers here, but what if there was happiness in the marriage? What would have happened if she'd left that marriage once she'd had a child, or as she did, three children?
Well, a woman then really didn't have any choice. There was no supporting mother's benefit. There was no widow's pension. There was no there was an old age pension by then. Either you threw yourself on the charity of the churches, or you went back home to your parents, if you were able to do that, or you did what Bert's mother did. I think they were probably the only choices. Mm. It's just horrendous to think of it.
So let's come, as you say, to the triumphant part of the story. Of course, what Dolly does, with all of the limits on her choices, she's obviously a very pragmatic woman as well as a very smart one. And within the constraints that confine her, she carves out a pretty good existence. Tell us about how she enjoyed that role of them, perhaps not so much the grocery shop, but when they got on to owning the pubs, and in particular the Caledonia.
Ah, yes. The Caledonian... That's right. The Caledonian was the best... It was the top hotel in Tamworth. Mum used to say it cost 4 shillings to have lunch at the Caledonian when you'd have a good feed at the Greeks for ninepence. So it was that kind of a place. It was the poshest hotel in town. And Mum always used to say, you know, Dolly and Bert had grown up kind of very poor. They had struggled. And the reason why they wanted the Caledonian Hotel is that it was close to where they had grown up as those struggling people. She said it was like the salmon returning. Mm. They wanted to show people how well they'd done. So I think Mrs. Russell of the Caledonian was a very happy woman.
Now, one thing I forgot to ask you, when we were talking about Dolly and Bert and them getting married, and we talked about that unfortunate wedding photo, it's not, as you say, all gloom and doom. I'd like you to read a passage about, that comes just when they're both just married and they've moved onto the property owned by her father.
Yes, it's a good... It's a great moment in her life, because it has all been pretty gloom and doom up till then. Blocked in every way, utterly sick of making bread and shepherding sheep and washing. I've got a page or two about what making a cup of tea involved in a house in, say, 1890. The fact that you had to, clear out the ashes from the day before. Oh, look, I won't go into it now, but there is a couple of pages... Whereas we just flick on the thing and stick the tea bag in and get the milk out of the fridge. We don't have to go and get the cow out of the paddock and find the food to put in the thing for it to eat and milk it and scour the pail and all that. So she was thoroughly sick of all that, and her life seemed gloomy, and she'd had this awful wedding experience and she was married to Bert. But where they went was to a farm outside of Gunnedah, which is further west, but, you know, way out. And they were going to share farm it. It was actually owned by Dolly's father. They were going to share farm it for a few years. And I can't imagine that Dolly was looking forward to that, but here she is on her first morning at Rothsay outside Gunnedah. Gunnedah was 50 miles from Currabubula, out on the Black Soil Plains to the northwest, and Rothsay, Dolly's father's place, was another 5 miles west of the town. The first morning there, she stood on the veranda looking down to the paddocks where the wheat was bending and shifting under a warm breeze. She couldn't believe how a day's journey had brought her to what might as well have been a different continent. Out here, there were no enfolding hills as at home. This was a landscape of height and air and space. There was that vast bowl of sky above her, and a sense of being able, just about, to see the curve of the earth as it turned through space. That gave you a weightless feeling. There was nothing to hold you down. You could float away. The house sat in the middle of the flatness, so from every window the eye could travel without obstacle all the way to the soft place where the horizon became the sky. Until now, as she looked over the gleaming endless land with its moving skin of wheat, she'd never realised just how closed, how narrow, how hemmed in things were at Curra, that village squeezed into the kink in the range. When you were in Curra, there were just two ways to go, down the kink to the south or up the kink to the north, and every single thing was familiar and old and stale. Was out here, whichever way you looked, the endless space was like an invitation. The track to Gunnedah, a wide, flat, open town on that wide, flat, open plain, ran past the front door. It would be a new beginning here. She wouldn't be Dolly Maunder, known to everyone since before she was born, everything about her already judged. She'd be Mrs. Bert Russell from out at Rothsay, a brand new person in the world who could make her own choices about who she was. Bert got up early every morning. She'd pretend to be asleep as he padded out to the kitchen in his socks. She'd hear him lighting the fire, filling the kettle. He was a man of habit. She knew the next sound would be the rattle of the bread box and the little knocking from where he was cutting the bread on the warped board. The tea caddy open and shut, the cup tinkling on its saucer. She'd known him just about all her life, so there hadn't been too many surprises after they married. She knew the way he pursed his lips towards his glass of beer, the way he smoothed his thick moustache after every swallow of it, the way he put his muscled hand down beside the plate when he'd finished his dinner. She knew what he liked in the middle of the day, a cold chop and a hunk of strong cheese. What he liked after tea, bread and jam. What he liked in bed, well, it wasn't too bad. He knew to sweet talk her first. "You're a pretty little thing, Dolly Russell," he whispered. And she didn't say, "How can you tell, Bert, it's dark?" The surprise was that the thing wasn't bad at all, not like some women made out. Dolly always had a project that fueled her all day. Some small things. She'd plant pansies in that old wagon wheel lying in the grass. She'd seen it done at Aunt Emma's at Bendemeer, and she'd never forgotten. Big things, too. Going over to the new kinds of wheat they were bringing out that didn't get the rust. No matter what you were doing, there was always a better way to do it. Whereas Bert was inclined to accept whatever came along. "Oh, well, we could," he'd say, when she told him about the wagon wheel or the new kind of wheat. It wasn't that he was lazy, though when she got cranky, she accused him of that. The real reason was he didn't like change. He plodded along, working hard, his horizon small, his ambitions modest, sticking to the familiar, not taking any risks. But she'd get an idea in her head and it wouldn't leave her. She'd keep at him and keep at him. "By God, Dolly," he said one day, resigned but admiring as well, "you never give up, do you?" And she didn't.
That could be her epitaph, Kate, couldn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, that's right.
"You never give up." Kate, I want to go back to what we were talking about why Dolly wanted Nance to do pharmacy and why she insisted on that so much, even over Nance's resistance. And you've said, of course, you touched on it today, but one of the things you said is, "What my grandmother gave my mother was the thing that she, Dolly, never had, financial independence and a set of choices in life." So, of course, that stood Nance in good stead, because when she married Ken, your father, he, for various reasons, had an erratic earning capacity, I suppose you could say. But Nance would have been able to leave him if she had wanted to, because she had financial independence. So I'm wondering this. At the end of your mother's life, she died about 20 years ago, very, very sadly, I think, she said to you, "Why did my mother never love me?" And I'm wondering, in light of the thought that you've given this and the analysis that you've done and what we've talked about, what answer you would give her today.
Yes, I would love to have that moment back. And now that I've understood a bit more about Dolly, be able to answer the question better. Why did my mother never love me? What a terrible question to ask your daughter on your deathbed. My heart breaks when I think of that. So if I had that miraculous 5 minutes with my mother again, I would say, "Listen, Dolly did actually love you. She loved you in a way more deeply than people who go all lovey-dovey and warm and fuzzy, because she was going to give you the gift that she had never had, the gift that she knew would make all the difference to your life. She loved you enough, actually, to make herself a nag, to make herself unpopular with you in order to give you what she knew from her own experience would transform your life for the better."
Independence.
Independence,
and choice.
Particularly financial independence and therefore the choice and the freedom that that gives you. And of course, as a result of that, my mother often said, I come from a long line of unhappy mothers having unhappy children, and that constant cycle going on. That's a very common thing in life, I think. She said, I am determined to break that cycle. And she did in spades. She was a fabulous mother. But one of the reasons she could do that was that her mother had given her that set of choices.
And those tools. So I've just got a couple more questions, but then I'll be opening up to questions from the floor. If you'd like to start thinking about any questions that you would like to ask Kate, I think the microphone's going to be in the centre of this aisle here. So if you would like to start thinking about questions you might want to ask while I just ask my last few. Kate, you've said about this book, in writing her story, Dolly's, I understand now how recent and how fragile my freedoms are and how much those silent women did for us. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, those fragile freedoms. Look, I suppose it's when you have children you realise how fragile your freedoms are as a woman, because you immediately walk into a place where no matter what you're doing, you are divided. You're a divided person. Maybe fathers feel that too. But if you're with your children, you're longing to be, you know, writing the book. If you're writing the book, you're longing to be with your children. Mm. That just seems to me like kind of baked hard into the situation. Is there any answer to that? I don't know that there is.
There's another lovely quote that I saw from you that I thought was really pertinent and really interesting. You've been doing this for the last few books, revealing the untold stories of women whose voices have been lost to history, your own mother and Elizabeth MacArthur, of course, the wife of John MacArthur in A Room Made of Leaves. And you've said this, and these are women whose voices have been lost to history and who you resurrect, really, through your writing. I write out of my experience as a woman, which, of course, is where my voicelessness comes from. The experience of being not heard or misheard is the experience of women of my generation. Mm. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Gee, a lot of you in this audience would relate to that, I imagine. How many of us have not been at a meeting where we came up with a good idea and put it forward? And total silence, it falls into the silence, and 3 minutes later someone in a suit up the other end of the table says, oh, look, I've got a bit of an idea here. Out it comes. So I think for younger women, I think it is changing. I certainly hope so. My daughter seems not to be that problem in her field. So I think things have come a long way, and that's fantastic. Each generation ought to be, like Dolly, I feel each generation ought to be able to kind of push open the doors a little bit more for the ones who come after. The thing is, we're pushing the doors open not just for our daughters, but also for our sons, because the flip side of all this that I've been talking about is that men also, this is what my book Dark Places was about actually, men also have been robbed of the chance to be all the things that they are as well, all the nurturing, soft, emotional things that men traditionally have not been allowed to be. So, you know, in pushing open those doors, everybody's going to benefit.
Kate, you've said one reason that you write is to use the micro... And you said this generally, not specifically about this book, but one reason that you like to write is to use the microcosm of fiction as a way of working through bigger puzzles about human behaviour. And I wondered if you could talk a bit about the puzzles about human behaviour. We may have touched on this earlier, but yes, what puzzles did you unravel, I suppose, as you were writing this book?
Yeah. Look, you did ask me earlier, and I know I skipped past the question because, frankly, I can't answer it.
No, okay.
By which I mean the puzzles are... They're worse than puzzles because some of them actually don't have a solution.
No.
Like the problem of being a mother and wanting to be in two places at once, and there are many other puzzles like that. So I don't have any... I think all I can do is ask the questions about those puzzles and say, look, here's the puzzles. Over to you as the reader. Make of it what you will. I have articulated the question for you and I hope that helps.
That seems like a great time now to turn to questions from the audience. Yes, please.
Thank you, Kate, for opening the door not just to women, but to men. Sorry, I didn't mean to go there. But, yeah, thank you for opening the doors. Just thinking about historical fiction, thinking about voices of the past, you're talking about voices of people that you know and there's very little information. How do we go about giving voice to historical figures, to those that we know nothing of, you know, the Anne Boleyns of the world or the Cleopatras, you know, the ones that we have a little bit of knowledge of but not very much? So,
look, it's a very good question, and it is the central question when you start telling fictional stories about real people. It's the heart of the question. Look, I think, I mean, obviously, all you can do is find out as much as you can about that person and then find out as much as you possibly can about the world that they came from. And beyond that, I think you just have to be bold enough to make it up. You may get it right, you may get it wrong. More likely, you'll get some bits right and some bits wrong. But somebody else can come along and write another version of the same story, and they will have a different. So eventually, if enough people triangulate in, enough questions will be raised. We can't hope for what we can't hope to kind of reconstruct the past, but perhaps we can give an understanding of how it's affected us, what those people did to shape the world that we live in.
Thank you. Next question.
This may be none of my business, and knowing that you're honest, you'll tell me just that. I didn't get to ask in your first session with the editors about, and this is so unfair, you mentioned dark places that you just mentioned there. I think you said it was your favorite or your best book. I'm not sure which. Can you please tell us why? And then the other question was, one of the questioners asked, on the other session, were there any titles that you of your books that you really wish hadn't taken other people's advice on? And you said yes, and that's all you said.
Yeah.
Would you like to share what didn't get on the cover of the book and also the other thing?
Yeah, look, the Dark Places thing, I think what I would have said was that it's the book I'm probably proudest of writing, because in many ways it was the hardest book I've ever written. It's basically about a father who sexually abuses his daughter, and it's written from his point of view. Mm-hmm. And it was a difficult, dark place to step into to write that book. But I thought if we're trying to understand the damage that men have done to women and that men have done to themselves, we need to sort of tell that story from the inside. And it was, I mean, I abandoned that book many times, but I kept coming back to it. And now I read it and I think, that was really worth doing, because it tells a story. Again, I don't think that there are any other books in the first person about a sexual abuser. I think I couldn't go there now, but I was young and brave and brash in those days. As for the titles, look, none leap to mind. In any case, it's all water under the bridge now. They're the titles that the books have. But thanks for asking.
Yes.
Hello. My English class studied a novel, The Secret River, last year. And obviously it was a really eye-opening book for someone who didn't know much about colonial sort of settlement and what that was like. But you depicted the Indigenous characters with so much sort of depth and humanity, like, as characters. Could you talk about the choice that you made to refer to them by these monikers, like Whisker Harry and that type of thing, rather than calling them their real names?
Okay. The question is about the Indigenous characters in The Secret River. I made a very deliberate choice. Look, I could begin by saying, in early drafts of The Secret River, I had Aboriginal characters speaking dialogue and having them fully kind of, you know, like the white characters. And I read that and I thought, this is phony, and it's actually worse than phony. I'm not sure that the word appropriation was kind of constantly bandied around back in 2000, but that was my instinct. So I decided not to go there. This is a story from the white point of view. It is the white person's story, because that's the story I feel I can tell. So the Indigenous characters are seen through the eyes of the white settlers, and that seemed to me the honest way to do it. And I thought, there are Indigenous writers who can kind of fill in that gap, and of course since then there have been many, many, many fabulous Indigenous writers who are doing that. It wasn't up to me to do that. Thanks for the question. Really good one.
Thank you.
My observation that I have had looking at women who struggle to forge themselves forward and find their own way is adaptability. And I was wondering if you might be able to comment on your mother and your grandmother about that quality.
Yeah, what a good question. Mm. Look, I've often wondered why Mum was not more damaged by her childhood, which was being the daughter of this very difficult woman, but also because they moved so often. Mum once said to me that she went to 14 different schools. She might have been slightly exaggerating, but just when I studied the geography of their travels, she was forever being the new kid at school. That's quite damaging. She was also often boarded out, either with family or strangers, which again can be quite damaging. She was very aware that her mother was kind of pushing her away. And I have always thought, why is it that some people are destroyed by that kind of experience? But my mother seems to have gained resilience from it and adaptability. And I think it's because she had an aunt that she just spent a little bit of time with, just a year or two. And that aunt was a deeply loving, accepting person. And I think it's the way Bruno Bettelheim says, a child needs just enough love and good enough love. It doesn't have to be perfect. So adaptability is very mysterious. I think if we could analyse it and bottle it, the world would be a better place, wouldn't it? Because lack of it leads us into a terrible kind of dead ends.
Any more? Could you step up to the microphone, please? In the meantime, I'll fill in with it. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I apologise. There's a line. Are you lining up to ask questions over here as well? No. Okay. Yes.
Thank you so much. And your talk today gave me a lot of insight into my mother and her mother as well. And I have vowed to ask more questions. I'm interested in this multi-generational story and any perception. I'm one of those working women who, you know, juggles and feels the guilt and but also the immense choice that I've been gifted by the maternal women, the women in my life. What do you have any sense of what we might be doing in the current generation that might be actually harmful in the way we are raising and the stories we're telling our daughters?
What a good question. Well, probably, because I think each generation does what they think is best, but it's in the nature of children to say, oh, my parents did this, my parents did that, what they did to me. So I think you can't hope to get it right. But and I think that's part of the price you pay for the great joy of being a parent, actually. but I think we have the duty to, tell the stories, but maybe not to say, this is the truth. Just to say, this was my experience and you're going to forge your own. Maybe that's the best thing we can give them. I think any sense that there is a right and a wrong and a definitive answer, I think that would be a very damaging idea to give our children. I think my children would say, don't worry, Mum, you've never given us a straight answer to anything, so you needn't worry about that.
Does anyone else have any questions? I just have one last one, Kate. I know that sometimes people have asked you, and I know that there's a very good answer, but sometimes you've been asked why you chose to tell Dolly's story in this particular form. I'm not going to call it fiction.
Okay.
It's a hybrid, I think.
Yeah.
There is a real choice that you made not to just write a biography. Could you talk about that choice?
Yes. In the beginning, it was just a straight biography. And, in fact, there's a version of it on Audible, much shorter and rather different, which is, in fact, just a straight biography. Mm. That's what I thought I was writing.
Mm.
But when I showed this to my publisher, he saw it very differently. And with every book, Michael has said something very insightful. And he said, look, you've actually written a novel, even though you kind of don't quite perhaps realise you've written it, because although you knew all the events of your grandmother's life, you had to imagine your way into what she thought and felt.
Mm.
To empathise with her, you had to write fiction. And he's absolutely right about that. He said, look, just put the stuff that you've got as an introduction at the end so that the reader reads what they think is a novel, and then, lo and behold, they come upon a photograph, which is the photograph of Dolly Maunder, a close-up of which is on the cover, and there's a little bit in Kate Grenville's voice. In fact, I tell the story of my grandmother coming upon me in the garden and asking, do you love me? So it is a hybrid. And then at the very end, there's a little bit that that is about all the different places where my grandparents lived, giving them their indigenous names and acknowledging that the family stories I drew on for this book are silent about the truth of our past. They record no awareness of the enduring sorrow that all that taking of land meant for First Nations people. As Dolly's granddaughter, I want to acknowledge that silence and that sorrow. I've told one story here, but standing beside it is another. So that dimension of the novel is very important to me. Mm. It's a novel framed in something else.
That seems like a very good place to wind up. Please take the opportunity to go and meet Kate, go and buy this wonderful book, go and meet Kate, get her to sign it for you, and please join with me in thanking Kate Grenville AO for our conversation today.
Thank you, Nicole. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.